It's a nuclear-powered web wisdom edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, all about allergies. Who killed the whooping cough? What's the diff between archaeology and paleontology? Accuracy and precision. Hidden meaning in common sayings. How thought viruses make us more angry. 10 great places to see before they disappear. And nuclear energies. The facts and arguments, pro and con. Let's begin episode 294.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week is another Web Wisdom special. Let's start off with a look at allergies. What are they, and why do we suffer from them?
For most of us, springtime means sunshine, green grass, and blooming flowers. But for some, it can also mean sneezing and watery eyes or even trouble breathing. We're talking about allergies, and almost anything can cause them. Grass, flowers, ragweed, peanuts, bee stings, penicillin, soy latex, the list goes on and on. An estimated 40% of the world's population suffers from allergies, and that number is on the rise. But how can a peanut, so small and simple and delicious, be so deadly? And what even are allergies anyway? How are they caused? Can they be prevented or even cured? Well, to understand allergies, we first need to talk about your immune system. Your immune system is meant to keep you healthy, but in people with allergies, they tend to overreact. And you can lay the blame on your lymphocytes, or white blood cells. Lymphocytes are like little hall monitors traveling around your body on the lookout for antigens, foreign invaders like parasites, bacteria, and viruses. When a lymphocyte detects an antigen, it begins producing large Y-shaped proteins called antibodies. Humans have almost 10 billion different kinds of antibodies, and each one binds to a specific antigen, neutralizing the threat. It's like having the keys to 10 billion different locks. But in an allergic person's immune system, the lymphocytes get confused. They treat allergens like they're antigens. Allergens themselves are really just a kind of enzyme called an antigenic protein. Scientists don't know what it is about the structure of these proteins that causes such alarm in some people's immune systems. They don't resemble viruses or bacteria, but the immune system still treats them like a threat. But doctors do know that while thousands of substances can be allergens, some are much more likely to send your immune system into overdrive. That's why just 8 foods account for 90% of all food allergies. Tree nuts, eggs, soy, peanuts, fish, shellfish, milk, and wheat. When someone's first exposed to an allergen, their lymphocytes create a bunch of antibodies called immunoglobulin E, or IgE. Everybody has IgEs, and when they attach to the surface of certain immune cells, those cells then release enzymes that help fight infections. It's all part of a defense system that evolved to protect us from parasitic worms and bacteria, and it's pretty effective, at least when it's working properly. But when an allergic person's lymphocytes are faced with an allergen, their immune cells freak out and overproduce these enzymes, causing the symptoms of an allergic reaction. These can include a runny nose, itching, or hives, localized swelling on the skin. More severe reactions can involve nausea, vomiting, or even trouble breathing. The severity of these reactions is dictated by a wide variety of factors, like how much of an allergen is in the body, and how concentrated the immune cells are that have IgEs bound to them, and how much of the enzyme they're producing. In some people, the histamine enzyme can be the problem. Histamine dilates blood vessels and increases mucus production, allowing infection-fighting cells to travel to an affected area. Too much of it can cause itching or a runny nose. But immune cells in other people might release a lot of an enzyme called tryptase, which is linked to the absolute worst reaction you can have, anaphylactic shock. An overload of histamine and tryptase can cause your blood pressure to plummet, then the bronchial tubes constrict, making it harder to breathe, and in some cases, the throat can swell too, cutting off the oxygen supply completely. Hundreds of people in the U.S. die every year from anaphylactic shock, which is why those who have severe allergies usually carry an epinephrine shot, just in case. Epinephrine is a form of adrenaline. When it's injected, it constricts the blood vessels and eases swelling, allowing the sufferer to hopefully breathe again. The effects only last about 20 minutes, though, so the person will usually get themselves to a doctor. So that's how allergies work. But why do we have allergies in the first place? I mean, how does it make sense that something totally harmless to one person can be lethal to another? Well, it doesn't make any sense, at least not yet. Scientists can't quite agree why we have allergies. They do know that allergies have a genetic component. Studies have shown that if you suffer from allergies, there's a 33% chance that your kid will develop allergies as well. And if both parents have allergies, that risk jumps to 70%. But it's not that the child inherits specific allergies, they're just more likely to develop them. So a parent who has an allergy to eggs could have a kid who isn't allergic to eggs, but is allergic to peanuts. Kids can outgrow their allergies, though. The extra IgEs that their bodies produce are at their highest levels before the age of 10, but they can drop drastically by the time they reach 30. And if someone has an allergy to one antigenic protein, there's a good chance they're allergic to other proteins as well. That's called cross-reactivity. So if you're allergic to ragweed pollen, you're more likely to be allergic to apples, because the protein structure in both are very similar. That's why the immune system treats them as the same antigen. Why certain people develop allergies isn't the only thing puzzling scientists, though. Allergies around the world have been rising since the early 1980s. Reports of food allergies among children in the US, for example, increased by 20% from 1997 to 2007. Some scientists suggest that air pollution might be to blame. Three studies in the early 1990s linked pollutants like sulfur dioxide and carbon monoxide to allergic asthma, which can cause shortness of breath and wheezing. In one series of studies, researchers found lower instances of allergies among children in what was then East Germany compared to those who grew up in the more developed West Germany. Even though the kids in East Germany were exposed to a lot more air pollution than those living in the West, scientists concluded that the Western pollution contained more carbon monoxide from automobile exhaust. But there are other theories too, like the idea first developed in 1989 known as microbial deprivation. This model essentially suggested that the modern industrialized world is just too dang clean. We know that allergies are highest among those who live in wealthy, developed countries and in urban areas, regardless of race or sex. According to microbial deprivation, children who grew up in these environments simply aren't subjected to enough dirt, grime, bacteria, and parasites, depriving them of what scientists call benign exposure. The hypothesis suggests that this benign exposure helps balance the immune system, giving it something to fight. Maybe when there aren't enough pathogens to keep it busy, it overreacts and attacks harmless things like pollen instead. There is some research to back this up, too. In 1998, one study suggested that children who went to daycare and thus were exposed to lots of viruses had lower instances of allergies than those who didn't go to daycare. And in 1999, a Swedish scientist noted that farmers' children who had regular contact with animals before the age of 7 and drank unpasteurized milk didn't develop as many allergies as children who lived in the city. Now, these scientists aren't suggesting that we return to the days of drinking dirty water, because a lot of those parasites and bacteria, like dysentery, killed people. 200 years of sanitation have brought a lot of good to the world. But researchers are noticing a correlation between an environment devoid of microbes and an increase in allergies. This link has led to an experimental form of treatment called helminth therapy. Helminths are parasitic worms, like hookworms, that people deliberately infest themselves with in order to ease their allergies. Sounds kind of gross, right? But recent studies are showing that it might actually work. For instance, a study in 2012 found that patients infected with worms needed less medication than those who were worm-free. The downside is those worms also gave the patients stomach aches, bad gas, and diarrhea. Yeah, I mean, parasitic worms will do that to you. Thankfully, there are ways around allergies that are slightly less horrifying. For example, in many cases, we actually know which antigenic proteins are causing the reaction, so we can get around them. Like, when it comes to eggs, we know that they have 4 different antigenic proteins in the whites alone, plus 3 more in the yolk. Meaning that someone whose immune system reacts to the antigenic protein in the white could be perfectly fine eating the yolk. And some of these proteins, specifically those in eggs and milk, can be destroyed by extensive and prolonged heat. One study showed that only 4% of children with an egg allergy reacted to a muffin after it was cooked for 30 minutes at 175 degrees Celsius. Heating the proteins had changed them enough that they weren't triggers anymore. And then there are more traditional forms of allergy treatments, like immunotherapy, which works by changing the way your body responds to allergens. Once or twice a week over the course of a year, a patient is injected with tiny doses of an allergen. Because the exposure is so low and so constant, the immune system gradually stops responding with IgE antibodies. Instead, it begins responding with IgG antibodies, another more common type of antibody that fights chronic infections. These IgGs don't bind with immune cells first, so they don't release histamines or other chemicals that cause allergic reactions. Instead, they bind to an antigen and neutralize it directly. The downside of these shots is that they're really expensive, time-consuming, and don't work on severe allergies, which can be triggered by even those small doses. To treat more severe allergies, researchers are looking into anti-IgE immunotherapy, which directly blocks the production of IgE and just takes the whole thing out of the equation. In this kind of treatment, patients are given shots of a drug called omalizumab, which binds to existing IgEs in the blood, rendering them useless. It also blocks future production of the antibody by binding to the lymphocytes that make it. But then, guess what? Some people, although really very few, are allergic to omalizumab. So the safest option, at least for people with food allergies, an avoidance diet, which is the official name for what the rest of us would call common sense. Just don't eat what you're allergic to. So if you're allergic to shellfish, skip the lobster. Boom. Problem solved.
Sorry, we're back. Damn antibodies. From allergies to the whooping cough, and some great women who took a deadly disease and turned it into a distant memory. Let's listen in.
Back in the early 1930s in the U.S., about 200,000 cases were reported every year of a disease that today is considered rare and easily preventable, pertussis, also known as whooping cough. It's a highly contagious airborne disease caused by Bordetella pertussis, a bacterium that attaches to the lining of the lungs and releases a toxin damaging lung tissue and causing inflammation. The inflammation causes a rapid, painful, and severe cough that forces the air out of your lungs until you inhale with a big, long whoop, giving the disease its nickname. Pertussis is particularly dangerous to infants under 2, and until there was a way to prevent it, it killed up to 6,000 children every year. But there are ways to prevent the disease today, thanks to the work begun 80 years ago by Grace Eldering and Pearl Kendrick, two women who used their training in science to develop the first whooping cough vaccine. And they did it in their spare time. Kendrick and Eldering met while working in a public health laboratory in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Both women were college-educated, but they came from pretty different backgrounds. Kendrick had studied bacteriology and worked at public health labs in New York before being appointed the director of the Michigan Bureau of Laboratories in Grand Rapids in 1926. Eldering was a small-town school teacher from Montana who came to Michigan looking for work. But both had demonstrated intelligence and ambition, which allowed them to find work in public health, a field known for hiring women at the time because money was tight and depression era America, and women were paid less than men. Another thing that Kendrick and Eldering had in common, they had both had and survived whooping cough as children, an experience that shaped their professional lives. So when Grand Rapids saw a pertussis outbreak in 1932, Kendrick and Eldering wanted to help, but the lab's director would only let them work on their ideas after they'd finished their usual tasks, mostly testing water and milk samples. Although their eventual goal was to create an effective pertussis vaccine, Kendrick and Eldering realized that they'd need to learn more about the bacteria first. So after the lab closed every day, Kendrick and Eldering went out into Grand Rapids, visiting the families of sick children and collecting samples on what were known as cough plates. The cough plates were basically what they sound like, just petri dishes you hold like 10 to 12 centimeters from the child's face, and they cough on it. With any luck, some mucus would land on the plate, and if it contained any pertussis bacteria, then little colonies would start to grow. At the time, the main thing they wanted to do was just find a way to rapidly cultivate these colonies, so doctors would have a way to diagnose the disease earlier and isolate contagious patients. Because back then, doctors weren't able to diagnose the disease until an ordinary cough grew into a whooping cough, by which time it was pretty much too late. Plus, all these cough plates would help Kendrick and Eldering figure out how long pertussis was contagious, based on whether, after a certain amount of time, children were still coughing up enough bacteria to form colonies on the cough plates. At the time, the standard growth medium on cough plates was fairly well established. A mixture of potato juice and blood did the trick. Potato juice might seem like a strange way to grow bacteria, but it was there to counteract the effects of the fatty acids in mucus, which is actually pretty good at inhibiting bacterial growth. By providing pertussis-friendly nutrients as well as starch to absorb the fatty acids, the potato juice helped the bacteria grow. More importantly, the blood provided material where the pertussis bacterium could really leave its mark. B. pertussis produces a toxin that rips apart red blood cells. After 3 to 6 days, the reaction can be detected under a microscope, allowing for quick confirmation of whether pertussis is present. Kendrick and Eldering decided to use sheep's blood instead of human blood because sheep's blood was much easier to come by, and it worked just as well. With this test in hand, Kendrick's lab spread the word to local doctors that they could send in cough plates to be tested for pertussis. With the hundreds of cough plates they collected, they were able to better understand the mechanics of the disease. For instance, they realized that during the first 3 weeks of infection, a patient's cough contained enough bacteria to infect others, but after 4 or 5 weeks, most patients were non-infectious. This allowed Kendrick and Eldering to establish the first science-based guidelines for quarantining whooping cough patients. Before this, there had been quarantines, but they varied anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, which Kendrick's lab showed was much too short. So the Grand Rapids Health Department enforced a quarantine of 35 days after the onset of symptoms, or 2 negative cough plates in a row within 28 days. For Kendrick and her cohorts, the next step after figuring out how to contain the outbreak was finding a treatment. They wanted a vaccine. A few attempts had been made to develop a pertussis vaccine, but none of them seemed to work. But new research out of the Netherlands at the time suggested that a whole cell vaccine might be the answer. In this scenario, scientists could cultivate the bacteria bacteria and kill it with chemical compounds like thimerosal or formalin. They'd inject the bacteria into the patient, but because the bacteria were dead, they couldn't actually infect the patient. But the process would still allow the patient's immune system to develop antibodies for pertussis, so if they were ever exposed to it again, they'd be able to fight back. The lab began producing autogenous vaccines, which were made for each individual patient upon request from their doctor, and prepared using that patient's specific strain of the bacteria. But after several months of handling requests one by one for autogenous vaccines, Kendrick appealed to her boss for permission to begin crafting a general vaccine made from several local recurring strains of pertussis. "Sure," her boss said, and this is a quote, "go ahead and do all you can with pertussis if it amuses you." So they set to work. Using the whole cell method and a mix of several local strains of bacteria, Kendrick and Eldering began testing a general vaccine on animals and themselves to make sure it was safe. After successfully concocting a general vaccine, they needed to test it in the field rather than just in the lab, so they launched a citywide field trial in Grand Rapids to find out if the vaccine actually worked. This was problematic for two reasons. In the early 1930s, there were no accepted standards for a vaccine field trial, no playbook. Also, it was the Great Depression, so money was scarce. Kendrick and Eldering cobbled together funding from federal emergency funds, the local health department, and private donors. They devised a plan wherein over 1,000 preschool-aged children would be split into two groups, an experimental group that the lab would inoculate, and a control group that would not be inoculated. The experimental group consisted of children from parents who volunteered to have them vaccinated at local health clinics. They were given a series of 4 to 5 injections of the vaccine. A volunteer nurse would then visit the child every 3 to 4 months to collect cough plates to see whether or not they had contracted pertussis. The nurse would also collect cough plates from children in the control group who were not inoculated. In October of 1935, Kendrick and Eldering presented their findings. Of the 1,592 children in the field trial, 880 made up the control group and 712 were vaccinated. And while there were 45 cases of pertussis in the unvaccinated control group, there were only 4 among the children who were given the vaccine, and those were mild cases. It was the first time a pertussis vaccine seemed to work. The federal government subsidized a follow-up study in 1938 in which children were given a smaller dose of the vaccine, 3 shots instead of 4 or 5. The study was just as successful as the first field trial, and soon thereafter, the Michigan Department of Health began mass-producing the vaccine. By 1940, it was available nationwide. Throughout the 1940s, Kendrick and Eldering continued to improve the vaccine with the help of Loni Gordon, an African-American dietitian who couldn't get a job in Grand Rapids until Kendrick hired her. Gordon examined thousands of cough plates looking for a more virulent strain of pertussis to make the vaccine even more effective. The 3 bacteriologists also worked to standardize the vaccine, developing new tests to check the concentration of any sample. Now, the whole culture vaccine wasn't perfect. It sometimes gave children fevers and convulsions. These days, we use a different vaccine to avoid those side effects. But in 1934, when Kendrick and Gordon first started testing the vaccine, 209 out of every 100,000 people got pertussis every year. In 1948, as vaccinations improved and became more popular, that number went down to 51 out of every 100,000. By 1960, it was less than 10. It was the first pertussis vaccine that was really effective, and those people saved thousands of lives.
And they did that in their spare time? Kind of makes me depressed, considering I've never done such great things in my spare time. Unless surviving 20 days and don't starve qualifies. No? No. But I could become an amateur archaeologist in my spare time and discover a new dinosaur. Again, no. And to explain what was wrong with that, let's listen in to this little bit about archaeology versus paleontology.
You want to know how to make an archaeologist really mad, really fast? Ask her about the dinosaurs she's found. People use catch-all shorthand terms for things all the time, even in science. Like, we might refer to one kind of physicist as an astronomer, even if he's never set his eye to an eyepiece, because the calculations that he works on have to do with the motions of stars and galaxies. It's just easier for people to understand when you're at a cocktail party, and it's basically accurate, so no harm done. But to use archaeology as a synonym for the study of dinosaurs and fossils and forms of ancient life, which is actually called paleontology, is not lazy shorthand, it's wrong. While the two disciplines do have some very basic principles in common, mixing up archaeology with paleontology is sort of like taking your sick kid to a wildlife biologist for a diagnosis or ordering a birthday cake from a chemist. People might understand why you've made that mistake, but they'd also tell you that you are way off. So let me help you know your scientists.
Archaeology, first of all, is the study of the human past through material remains. Not human remains, at least the vast majority of the time, but through the traces that people have left behind in the process of living their lives. Those things could be artifacts, basically any objects that a human made or used, or features, things that people made that can't be moved, like a wall or a ditch, or an old hearth full of charcoal. Paleontology, by contrast, deals with the even more distant past. It's the study of ancient life of all kinds, mostly but not always by investigating fossils, the mineralized remains of living things. It kind of makes sense that the two fields are often confused for each other because they both use science to understand history, and they both involve a lot of digging. In fact, the main thing that archaeology and paleontology have in common is the basic understanding that the deeper down you dig below Earth's surface, the farther back in time you go. The surface of the Earth is always reworking itself, after all, whether it's because of plants dying and turning into topsoil, or volcanic eruptions covering everything in ash, or floods laying down new layers of sediment. That's why both archaeologists and paleontologists are trained in the science of reading these layers, a branch of geology called stratigraphy. But that's about where the similarities end, because archaeologists and paleontologists explore the strata of Earth at different depths, looking for different things. You might not have to dig too far to find, like, stone spear points from a few thousand years ago, but to reach back further into the past and find a fossil of a pteranodon, you gotta get into older layers of Earth. So archaeologists study human history, but humans have been around a long time, and we've left a lot of history lying around, so it makes sense that there are different kinds of archaeology. Since most of our history hasn't been written down, a lot of archaeologists study prehistory. Now, prehistory doesn't mean before there was history, obviously. There's always been history. But simply a time before historical events were actually documented, either in writing or in oral traditions that can help us understand what we find in the ground. So the investigation of cultures that thrived before they fixed their history into words is prehistoric archaeology. The Stone Age dwellers of the Levant, the hunter-gatherers of America, even the cultures that created Stonehenge and the great houses of Chaco Canyon all fit into this category. But even after historical records started to become a thing, there were still lots of gaps for us to fill in, so historical archaeology is dedicated to exploring the lives of people who lived during recorded history. Classical archaeology, for example, focuses on ancient Western cultures like those of Greece and Rome. Industrial archaeology explores old ways of engineering, mining, and manufacturing. There's even a whole subfield of maritime archaeology, which just investigates shipwrecks. None of these fields, you'll notice, involve raiding tombs or snatching golden idols from booby-trapped chambers or punching Nazis. Archaeologists just like to dig and find stuff, and more often than not, leave them where they found them. Paleontology is just as diverse. As soon as I mentioned fossils, you probably go straight to thinking about dinosaurs, and yeah, lots of paleontologists study dinosaurs. But there are even more who study other kinds of ancient life. Salamanders as big as people, sloths as big as bears, winged reptiles the size of giraffes. All of these animals were once real and are now extinct, and they fall under the umbrella of paleontology. Not to mention all other forms of life, invertebrates like insects and mollusks and plants and all manner of microscopic life. There are even fields devoted expressly to the study of things like pollen and ancient animal tracks. So, next time you're at a cocktail party and somebody says they're an archaeologist, ask them about what sites, artifacts, or features they're working on. Maybe ask whether they do historic or prehistoric archaeology, or if they work in the ground or underwater. Just please, for the love of Pete, do not mention dinosaurs or Nazis.
And now that we know what not to say at a party, we can now remind ourselves, what is the difference between being accurate versus being precise?
As the story goes, the legendary marksman William Tell was forced into a cruel challenge by a corrupt lord. William's son was to be executed unless William could shoot an apple off his head. William succeeded, but let's imagine two variations on the tale. In the first variation, the Lord hires a bandit to steal William's trusty crossbow, so he is forced to borrow an inferior one from a peasant. However, the borrowed crossbow isn't adjusted perfectly, and William finds that his practice shots cluster in a tight spread beneath the bullseye. Fortunately, he has time to correct for it before it's too late. Variation 2. William begins to doubt his skills in the long hours before the challenge, and his hand develops a tremor. His practice shots still cluster around the apple, but in a random pattern. Occasionally, he hits the apple, but with the wobble, there is no guarantee of a bullseye. He must settle his nervous hand and restore the certainty in his aim to save his son. At the heart of these variations are two terms often used interchangeably, accuracy and precision. The distinction between the two is actually critical for many scientific endeavors. Accuracy involves how close you come to the correct result. Your accuracy improves with tools that are calibrated correctly and that you're well trained on. Precision, on the other hand, is how consistently you can get that result using the same method. Your precision improves with more finely incremented tools that require less estimation. The story of the stolen crossbow was one of precision without accuracy. William got the same wrong result each time he fired. The variation with the shaky hand was one of accuracy without precision. William's bolts clustered around the correct result, but without certainty of a bullseye for any given shot. You can probably get away with low accuracy or low precision in everyday tasks, but engineers and researchers often require accuracy on microscopic levels with a high certainty of being right every time. Factories and labs increase precision through better equipment and more detailed procedures. These improvements can be expensive, so managers must decide what the acceptable uncertainty for each project is. However, investments in precision can take us beyond what was previously possible, even as far as Mars. It may surprise you that NASA does not know exactly where their probes are going to touch down on another planet. Predicting where they will land requires extensive calculations, fed by measurements that don't always have a precise answer. How does the Martian atmosphere's density change at different elevations? What angle will the probe hit the atmosphere at? What will be the speed of the probe upon entry? Computer simulators run thousands of different landing scenarios, mixing and matching values for all of the variables. Weighing all the possibilities, the computer spits out the potential area of impact in the form of a landing ellipse. In 1976, the landing ellipse for the Mars Viking lander was 62 by 174 miles, nearly the area of New Jersey. With such a limitation, NASA had to ignore many interesting but risky landing areas. Since then, new information about the Martian atmosphere, improved spacecraft technology, and more powerful computer simulations have drastically reduced uncertainty. In 2012, the landing ellipse for the Curiosity lander was only 4 miles wide by 12 miles long, an area more than 200 times smaller than Viking's. This allowed NASA to target a specific spot in Gale Crater, a previously unlandable area of high scientific interest. While we ultimately strive for accuracy, precision reflects our certainty of reliably achieving it. With these two principles in mind, we can shoot for the stars and be confident of hitting them every time.
If I can get my accuracy precise enough, we should be experiencing a break right about now.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
And we're back. Ever wonder why we say icebreaker when no ice is involved? Well, listen to some of the hidden origins to our common sayings.
Throughout the time that our language has developed, idioms and common phrases came about that we simply sometimes say on reaction when they're relevant. When you're expecting a retort, you say, "The ball is in your court." When someone tries passing off blame to another, you say, "It takes two to tango." With each idiom, there is often an origin of where they came from. So, here are my top 10 hidden meanings behind common sayings. Number 10. break the ice. An icebreaker is something that is supposed to get someone to open up to strangers. Strangers are scary sometimes, and people are very wary about them. Just think about your early college years, when you had to introduce yourself to your classmates by asking their names, favorite color, and other various questions. Back before trains, cars, or planes, port cities thrived on trading goods via ships. But during the winters, rivers would often freeze over and prevent any commercial ships from trading with them. So, a smaller ship with a sturdy build would break through the ice and rescue stranded ships. So today, people are often told to have icebreakers and to break the ice before they can start projects or friendships. Friendships. Number 9. Run amok. To run amok means to go crazy, wild, and bring on chaos. And this comes from the Malaysian word amok, which was used to describe tribesmen who would become a rampaging wild mob that attacked anyone who crossed their paths. This was also done under the influence of opium. Number 8. Kick the bucket. Do you know what my granddad said to me before he kicked the bucket? He said, "Grandson, how far do you think I can kick this bucket?" Anyway, someone kicking the bucket is a common phrase used when someone or something dies. When a cow was sent to a slaughterhouse, it was strung up on a thing called a bucket. Sometimes, after death, the animal's leg would kick the bucket as it died. Number 7. Cat got your tongue? This saying is used when someone can't respond or find themselves at a loss for words. The origin of this saying isn't actually clear, but many people have made up new backgrounds for it. They often say that sailors would get whipped with the cat o' nine tails, and the pain was so unbearable that they couldn't even cry out in agony. Other origins is that a person's tongue would be cut out and thrown to the cats for spreading lies and blasphemy. None of these have any solid evidence to prove where it actually came from, though the French have a saying, I can't read French. On screen here, literally means, I throw my tongue to the cat. But that is used for when someone has nothing to say. Number 6. Go cold turkey. Going cold turkey is a phrase used when someone wants to quit something that is extremely difficult by simply stopping. It's often used with smokers who are trying to quit. This is because people thought that an addict's skin, while going through withdrawal, would become rough to the touch, covered in goosebumps, and become overly pale and translucent. This is the same look of a plucked turkey. Number 5. More than you can shake a stick at. Having more of something than you actually need is what we use this phrase for, and where this particular phrase came from is exactly how it's used today. Before, farmers corralled and controlled their sheep by shaking their shepherd's staff to direct the livestock on where to go. When the farmer couldn't control all of their sheep, it was commonly said that they had more than you can shake a stick at. Number 4. Saved by the Bell. No, this isn't that 80s, 90s TV show about American high school kids. Instead, this bell was used to rescue someone from being buried alive. And while the school bell does help one from being rescued by an unwanted situation, this was far more dire than someone finding a diary and is about to read it out loud. People were often buried with their hands holding a rope. This rope was connected to a bell by the tombstone. And at night, the guard would listen for any bells, in case they needed to quickly dig up a person. Number 3. Waking up on the wrong side of the bed. Ever wake up feeling angry or upset for no real reason? Snapping at someone who dared talk to you after you just awoke from your slumber? You probably got told that you woke up on the wrong side of the bed. That's such a weird thing to say to someone, don't you think? But that was because it was a superstition that anything to do with the left side of the body was considered to be satanic and sinister. Which makes you wonder why people wear wedding rings on their left hand, and why the heart is closer to the left side. To ward off any evil, innkeepers would make sure that the left side of the bed was completely flushed up against the wall, forcing the tenant to get up on the right side of the bed. This explains why, back in the day, people didn't like lefties. Number 2. Go the whole nine yards. Going the whole nine yards describes someone who would try their hardest. While the origin isn't completely known, it does have a few explanations. The most common one accepted is during World War II, fighter pilots had a 9-yard chain of ammo to use, and when he used all of the ammo on the intended target, he gave it the whole 9 yards. Number 1. Blood is thicker than water. Many people use this saying to show the family bonds. The blood part is often used to signify a relation between the people involved. But what is the water meant to be? Well, an older saying is, blood is thicker than the water of the womb. This means that we often use this phrase backwards. The blood is speculated to represent the bond between warriors and soldiers that are made in battle, and is a nice sentiment of how you can consider someone family who isn't from the same household as you. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this little roundup of idioms and their origins.
Before you start commenting about how wrong some of that was, let's find out how thought viruses will always drive people to extremes, at least on the internet. Let's listen in.
Hello, Internet. Thoughts compete for space in your brain. Cat photos, news stories, belief structures, funny GIFs, educational videos, not-so-educational videos, and your thinking inventory is limited. A thought without a brain to think it dies. Now, we can treat thoughts as though they're alive, specifically alive like germs. That might sound weird, but stick with me. Take jokes. Jokes are thought germs that live in your brain, and when you tell the joke to another brain, you help it to reproduce, just like when you have the flu and sneeze to help it reproduce. This germ gets into its host by snot through the mouth and this one by words through the ear, but it's reproduction either way. Logging onto your social media then is exposing yourself to everyone's mental sneezes. Each post a glob of snot with a thought germ trying to get into your brain. If not for permanent residence, then at least long enough to get you to press the share button and sneeze it with everyone you know. In this analogy then, a funny cat photo with the perfect caption is a superflu. Now, just as germs exploit weak points in your immune system, so do thought germs exploit weak points in your brain, aka emotions. Once inside, thought germs that press emotional buttons get their hosts to spread them more, measurably more. Well, except sadness. Sad thoughts don't get very far. Awe is pretty good, which is why websites that construct thought germs like biological weapons arm them with titles like 7 whatevers that will blow your mind or the shocking secret behind this thing. But anger is the ultimate edge for a thought germ. Anger bypasses your mental immune system and compels you to share it like nothing else. Being aware of your brain's weak spots is necessary for good mental health, like knowing how to wash your hands. Because even without intentional construction, any thought germ on the internet can, on its own, grow more infectious as it spreads. To talk about why, let's forget anger for a moment and go back to that cat photo. Every photo ever taken is a thought germ, and most die a quick death like the bazillion cat photos, or baby photos, posted on the internet that are never shared. But a mildly funny cat photo can grow into so much more, because just as transatlantic flights were the best thing to happen to germ germs, so the internet is the best thing to happen to thought germs. For once on board, that cat photo can leap into other brains, and those brains might share it, and here's the key point, occasionally change it. A Photoshop here, a tweaked caption there. Most changes are terrible, but some make the thought germ even funnier, getting more brains to share it, which results in more changes and a shot at superstardom. Thus, a lowly cat photo can achieve global brain domination, at least for a few hours. The internet, with its unparalleled ability to share and randomly change thought germs, can't help but make them stronger. With jokes, that's awesome, but with angry germs, not always so awesome, no. Angry germs, the more they're shared, undergo the same process, changing and distorting to be more aggravating. These have a better chance of spreading than their possibly more accurate, but probably also more boring, rivals. But like plagues, thought germs can burn through a population too quickly. Just watch your favorite meme-generating machine for a week and you'll see the life cycle fly by. However, some thought germs germs have found a way around burnout. Now, I must warn you, depending on which thought germs live in your head and which you fight for, the next section might sound horrifying. So please keep in mind, we're talking about what makes some thought germs successful, particularly angry ones, and not how good or how bad the thoughts themselves are. Deep breath, calm. Thought germs can burn out because once everyone agrees, it's hard to keep talking and thus thinking about them. But if there's an opposing thought germ, an argument, then the thinking never has to stop. The disagreement doesn't have to be angry, but again, angry helps. The more visible an argument gets, the more bystanders it draws in, which makes it more visible, which is why every group from the most innocuous internet forum to the national conversation can turn into a double rage storm across the sky in no time. Wait, these thought germs aren't competing, they're cooperating. Working together, they reach more brains and hold their thoughts longer than they could alone. Thought germs on opposite sides of an argument can be symbiotic. One tool symbiotic anger germs in particular can employ is you're with us or against us. Whatever thought germ just leapt to the front of your brain, push it back. This video isn't about that. We're just talking about this tool, which makes it very hard for neutral brains to resist, and its divisiveness also grows its symbiotic partner. This explains why, in some arguments, gaining more allies also gains more enemies. Because though the participants think they're involved in a fiery battle to the death, from the anger germ's perspective, one side is a field of flowers and the other a flock of butterflies. Of course planting more flowers will get you more butterflies, and getting more butterflies will pollinate more flowers. If there is some argument that splits the population and lasts forever, and that even the most neutral people find difficult to avoid, you just might be looking at a super successful pair of symbiotic anger germs that have reached ecological stability. Now, one final depressing thought, one more awe-inspiring point that will reveal the secrets of, it's just depressing. When opposing groups get big, they don't really argue with each other, they mostly argue with themselves about how angry the other group makes them. We can actually graph fights on the internet to see this in action. Each becomes its own quasi-isolated internet sharing thoughts about the other. You see where this is going, right? Each group breeds thought germs about the other, and as before, the most enraging, but not necessarily the most accurate, spread the fastest. The group almost can't help but construct a totem of the other so enraging they'll talk about it all the time, which, now that you know how thought germs grow, is exactly what makes the totem always perfectly maddening. Now, all this isn't to say there's no point in arguing. That's a different video. Or that the internet isn't amazing, or that there aren't things worth trying to change people's minds about. Thought germs of all kinds come and go. But it's useful to be aware of how thoughts can use our emotions to spread, and how the more rapidly a thought is able to spread, the more chances it has to become even better at spreading through random changes that are made to it. Sometimes that's great, sometimes it's terrible. But if you want to maintain a healthy brain, it pays to be cautious of thoughts that have passed through a lot of other brains and that poke you where you're weakest. It's your brain. Be hygienic with it.
And we're back. I think if you wanted to get angry about something, here are 10 great places to visit that won't likely be there in the near future.
Ten places to visit before they disappear. Number 10, the Great Barrier Reef. Each year, 1.6 million adventurous travelers flock to Australia's Great Barrier Reef in a bid to find Nemo for themselves. Increased water temperature has bleached the coral white, leaving it weak and unable to fight disease. Meanwhile, the ocean's growing acidity is preventing the coral from developing strong supporting skeletons, resulting in it dissolving into nothing. Although today we can still see the 344,400 square kilometers of coral from space, by 2100 it could have disappeared altogether. Number 9. North Africa. The world's biggest desert, the African Sahara, is threatening to become even bigger. Expanding at a rate of 800 meters a month, the desertification of the continent has been caused by a combination of unsustainable agricultural practices and rising temperatures. Around 319 million hectares of Africa are thought to be vulnerable to desertification, which can lead to crop failure, famine, and drought. This transformation could have enormous repercussions, with up to 50 million people displaced from their homes over the next 10 years. Number 8. Glacier National Park. Once home to 150 stunning glaciers, Montana's Glacier National Park has been hit by rising temperatures which have eradicated all but 25 of them. And by 2020, even these too could have melted away. Home to the stonefly insect, which isn't found anywhere else on Earth, if the glaciers continue to disappear, so will this incredibly rare creature. This in turn will trigger a domino effect that will destroy the food chain and cause irreparable damage to the entire ecosystem. Number 7. The Magdalen Islands. Situated in Quebec, the Magdalen Islands' picturesque cliff faces are being eradicated by fierce winds, which are chipping away 100 centimeters of the cliff face each year. Although the island is currently protected by an ice cover that obstructs storm waves and fierce winds, homes have already had to be moved further inland, and one has actually been swept out to sea. However, scientists estimate that thanks to rising temperatures, the island can wave goodbye to its primary defense within the next 75 years. Number 6. Madagascar. Home to countless species of wildlife, over 80% of Madagascar's flora and fauna can be found nowhere else on Earth. Yet this hasn't stopped us from destroying 258,999 square kilometers of the forest through illegal logging and burning land for farming. Just 51,700 square kilometers remain. And it's not just plant life at risk. Madagascar is home to the world's entire wild lemur population, which has been recognized as the most endangered mammal on Earth. If nothing is done to protect the island, the forest will have disappeared within the next 35 years, taking these lovable furry critters with them. Number 5. The Great Wall of China. One of China's greatest landmarks, the Great Wall has lost two-thirds of its length thanks to years of decay. It has been smashed through to make room for new highways, locals have removed stone from it to use in their own homes, and in 2009, miners even knocked holes in it while prospecting for gold. In addition, fierce sandstorms are striking the wall, transforming sections of the once imposing defense structure into mounds of dirt. With 50% of the 6,400-kilometer wall already completely eradicated, today, only 20% of the structure is thought to be in a reasonable condition. Number 4. The Amazon Rainforest. An area the size of Connecticut is being secretly removed from the Amazon rainforest each year. While much of the forest is cleared for farming and grazing, another 15,500 square kilometers are removed annually through selective logging, the smuggling of high-profit wood. Undoubtedly, those most keenly affected are the tribes who live in the forest. Since the 1900s, over 90 tribes have been destroyed. Meanwhile, up to 38 animal species are expected to become regionally extinct by 2050 if their habitat is not saved. If the destruction continues, we may have just 50 years before the world's biggest rainforest disappears for good. Number 3. The Dead Sea. If you're hoping to cure your aches and pains in the famous healing water of the Dead Sea, you may only have until 2065 to do so. Just two-thirds the size it was 40 years ago and dropping by 1.2 meters every year, the ancient sea is diminishing thanks to those who are drawing water from the sea's only water source, the River Jordan. Number 2. The Maldives. At just 1.5 meters above sea level, the Maldives is the lowest lying country in the world, making it the number one victim of rising sea levels. With water rising by 0.9 centimeters every year, it's highly likely that the country in its entirety will be completely uninhabitable in the next 100 years. The threat of complete submersion is so great that the country's government have bought land in other countries, which is reserved for any citizens facing displacement. Number 1. Venice. If you've ever fancied floating down Venice's canals on a gondola, then you'd better book your flight to Italy soon, as the famous city could soon be submerged thanks to a significant increase in floods. Though the city has been slowly sinking for years, in 1900 the city experienced a maximum of only 10 floods. Over a century later, it is being rocked by around 60 each year. As a result, in 70 years the historic city might be beyond repair.
We're going to stop and take a bit of a break while you finalize your travel plans to see some of those great places while you still can. We'll be right back after this.
Have you received your Metro Vancouver Transportation and Transit Plebiscite voting package? If you didn't receive your voting package and you would like one mailed to you, simply call Elections BC at 1-800-661-8683. That's 1-800-661-8683. Or go online at elections.bc.ca/OVR to register or update your voter information and ask for a voting package to be mailed to you. This message is brought to you by Elections BC.
And we're back. Here is a series of segments about nuclear power, how it's made, the arguments pro and con for its use. Let's listen in.
Have you ever been in an argument about nuclear power? We have, and we found it frustrating and confusing. So let's try and get to grips with this topic. It all started in the 1940s. After the shock and horror of the war and the use of the atomic bomb, nuclear energy promised to be a peaceful spin-off of the new technology, helping the world get back on its feet. Everyone's imagination was running wild. Would electricity become free? Could nuclear power help settle the Antarctic? Would there be nuclear-powered cars, planes, or houses? It seemed that this was just a few years of hard work away. One thing was certain, the future was atomic. Just a few years later, there was a sort of atomic age hangover. As it turned out, nuclear power was very complicated and very expensive. Turning physics into engineering was easy on paper, but hard in real life. Also, private companies thought that nuclear power was much too risky as an investment. Most of them would much rather stick with gas, coal, and oil. But there were many people who didn't just want to abandon the promise of the atomic age. An exciting new technology, the prospect of enormously cheap electricity, the prospect of being independent of oil and gas imports, and in some cases, a secret desire to possess atomic weapons provided a strong motivation to keep going. Nuclear power's finest hour finally came in the early 1970s when war in the Middle East caused oil prices to skyrocket worldwide. Now, commercial interest and investment picked up at a dazzling pace. More than half of all the nuclear reactors in the world were built between 1970 and 1985. But which type of reactor to build, given how many different types there were to choose from? A surprising underdog candidate won the day, the light water reactor. It wasn't very innovative, and it wasn't too popular with scientists, but it had some decisive advantages. It was there, it worked, and it wasn't terribly expensive. So, what does a light water reactor do? Well, the basic principle is shockingly simple. It heats up water using an artificial chain reaction. Nuclear fission releases several million times more energy than any chemical reaction could. Really heavy elements on the brink of stability, like uranium-235, get bombarded with neutrons. The neutron is absorbed, but the result is unstable. Most of the time, it immediately splits into fast-moving, lighter elements, some additional free neutrons, and energy in the form of radiation. The radiation heats the surrounding water, while the neutrons repeat the process with other atoms, releasing more neutrons and radiation in a closely controlled chain reaction. Very different from the fast, destructive runaway reaction in an atomic bomb. In our light water reactor, a moderator is needed to control the neutrons' energy. Simple, ordinary water does the job, which is very practical since water is used to drive the turbines anyway. The light water reactor became prevalent because it's simple and cheap. However, it's neither the safest, most efficient, nor technically elegant nuclear reactor. The renewed nuclear hype lasted barely a decade, though. In 1979, the Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Pennsylvania barely escaped a catastrophe when its core melted. In 1986, the Chernobyl catastrophe directly threatened Central Europe with a radioactive cloud, and in 2011, the drawn-out Fukushima disaster sparked new discussions and concerns. While in the 1980s, 218 new nuclear power reactors went live, their number and nuclear's global share of electricity production has stagnated since the end of the 80s. So what's the situation today? Today, nuclear energy meets around 10% of the world's energy demand. There are about 439 nuclear reactors in 31 countries. About 70 new reactors are under construction in 2015, most of them in countries which are growing quickly. All in all, 160 new reactors are planned worldwide. Most nuclear reactors were built more than 25 years ago with pretty old technology. More than 80% are various types of light water reactor. Today, many countries are faced with a choice. The expensive replacement of the aging reactors, possibly with more efficient but less tested models, or a move away from nuclear power towards newer or older technology with different cost and environmental impacts. So, should we use nuclear energy? The pro and contra arguments will be presented here. Three reasons why we should stop using nuclear energy. 1. Nuclear weapons proliferation. Nuclear technology made a violent entrance onto the world stage. Just 1 year after the world's first ever nuclear test explosion in 1944, two large cities were destroyed by just two single bombs. After that, reactor technology slowly evolved as a means of generating electricity, but it's always been intimately connected with nuclear weapons technology. It's nearly impossible to develop nuclear weapons without access to reactor technology. In fact, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty serves the purpose of spreading nuclear reactor technology without spreading nuclear weapons, with limited success. In 40 years, five countries have developed their own weapons with the help of reactor technology. The fact of the matter is that it can be very hard to distinguish a covert nuclear weapons program from the peaceful use of nuclear energy. In the 1970s, the big nuclear powers were happily selling peaceful technology to smaller countries, which then developed weapons of their own. The road to deadly nuclear weapons is always paved with peaceful reactors. 2. Nuclear waste and pollution. Spent nuclear fuel is not only radioactive, but also contains extremely poisonous chemical elements like plutonium. It loses its harmfulness only slowly over several tens of thousands of years. And there is also a process called reprocessing, which means the extraction of plutonium from spent nuclear fuel. It can be used for two purposes, to build nuclear weapons or to use it as new fuel. But hardly any of it is used as fuel because we don't have the right kind of reactors for that. A milligram will kill you, a few kilograms make an atomic bomb, and even an inconspicuous country like Germany literally has tons of the stuff just lying around because reprocessing sounded like a good idea decades ago. And where will all the waste go? After dumping it into the ocean was forbidden, we've tried to bury it, but we can't find a place where it will definitely stay secure for tens of thousands of years. Over 30 countries operate nearly 400 reactors, managing several hundred thousands of tons of nuclear waste, and only one is currently serious about opening a permanent civilian waste storage, tiny Finland. 3. Accidents and disasters. Over 60 years of nuclear power usage, there have been 7 major accidents in reactors or facilities dealing with nuclear waste. 3 of those were mostly contained, but 4 of them released significant amounts of radioactivity into the environment. In 1957, 1987, and 2011, large areas of land in Russia, Ukraine, and Japan were rendered unfit for human habitation for decades to come. The number of deaths is highly disputed, but probably lies in the thousands. These disasters happened with nuclear reactors of very different types, in very different countries, and several decades apart. Looking at the numbers, we may as well ask ourselves, are 10% of the world's energy supply worth a devastating disaster every 30 years? Would 30% be worth another Fukushima or Chernobyl somewhere on Earth every 10 years? What area would have to be contaminated so we say no more? Where is the line? So, should we use nuclear energy? The risks may outweigh the benefits, and maybe we should stop looking into this direction and drop this technology for good. Three reasons why we should continue using nuclear energy. 1. Nuclear energy saves lives. In 2013, a study conducted by NASA found that nuclear energy has prevented around 1.8 million deaths. Even if you include the death tolls from Chernobyl and Fukushima, nuclear energy ranks last in death per energy unit produced. While nuclear waste is really toxic, it's usually stored somewhere, while the toxic byproducts of fossil fuels are pumped into the air we breathe every day. So, just by reducing the amount of fossil fuels burned, countless cases of cancer or lung disease and accidents in coal mines have been avoided. If we can choose between lots of dangerous stuff being put into a deep hole and lots and lots and lots of dangerous stuff being pumped into the atmosphere, the former seems more logical. Nuclear energy feels way more dangerous, though. Single catastrophic events burn into our memory, while coal and oil kill silently.
It's like the death rate of flying versus driving. Even in the best case scenario, it would take at least 40 years to switch to 100% renewable energy. So for as long as we continue using fossil fuels, nuclear energy will save way more lives than it destroys. 2. Nuclear energy reduces CO2 emissions. Nuclear energy is arguably way less harmful to the environment in terms of climate change than fossil fuels, our main source of energy. Since 1976, about 64 gigatons of greenhouse gas emissions have not been pumped out thanks to nuclear energy. And by the mid-21st century, that could amount to an additional 80 to 240 gigatons. Humanity's energy consumption is rising steadily. According to US government projections, China alone will add the equivalent of a new 600 megawatt coal plant every 10 days for the next 10 years. China already burns 4 billion tons of coal each year. Coal is cheap, relatively abundant, and easy to get to, so it's not likely that humanity will stop using it soon. Nuclear energy might be the only way of dampening the effects of climate change and preventing a catastrophic man-made global warming. Compared to the other things we do, nuclear energy is relatively clean. So even if it is a good idea to quit nuclear energy long-term, it might be a good solution for the next 100 years or so, compared to the alternatives. 3. New technologies. Maybe technology will solve the problem of nuclear waste and dangerous power plants. The nuclear reactors we've used so far are mostly outdated technology because nuclear innovation stopped in the 1970s. There are models like the thorium reactor that could solve the problem altogether. Thorium is abundant, really hard to turn into nuclear weapons, and up to two orders of magnitude less wasteful than current nuclear reactors. The waste material might also be only dangerous for a few hundred years, in contrast to a couple of thousand years. 1 ton of thorium is estimated to provide the same amount of energy as 200 tons of uranium or 3.5 million tons of coal. So while we cannot know for sure if alternative nuclear technology will keep its promises, shouldn't we at least do more research before we forego an opportunity to solve lots of humanity's current problems? It might not be an easy challenge, but that hasn't stopped us before. So, should we use nuclear energy? There are risks involved in any great human endeavor, and we have to make an informed decision rather than rely on gut feeling.
Well, now I feel energized and informed. So let's get out there and spread the word, whatever that may be for you. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siyam, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Anthas Yakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo.